Well, good evening, everybody. How are you? Nice to see you all here. I hope it's not too warm for you in this room. We're going to try to cool it down as much as we possibly can. Please help yourself to some water or whatever you need if you need to cool down a little bit. I'm John Hess. I'm the general manager of Boise State Public Radio. I want to thank you all for coming tonight, and thank you for your loyalty and support of Boise State Public Radio. Your support, your annual support, whatever you give to the station, helps support national programming like Morning Edition and also helps support our whole operation and all our translator stations and stations throughout Southwest and Central Idaho. So thank you so much. An event like this is really not possible without a lot of staff people who work on it. So I want to make sure that we recognize those folks. I want to thank Adrienne Zachary, who's our marketing manager. She's back there actually closing the blinds. Kaylee Ostrowski, who's our student, who's probably out at the check-in. Kelly Palmer, who's our director of development. Kelly, where are you? Right there, back there in the back. Paul Stribling, who's our director of programming. He's right back there. And Scott Graff, who is also our news director and part-time Morning Edition host right now, is back there as well. Adam Cotterell, where are you, sir? Adam? He's our Mr. Microphone tonight, but he's also one of our great reporters. And also Emily Ritter Saunders, who's sitting right there. She'll be taking photographs and tweeting and doing some stuff on Facebook. Paul Cox, who stands right next to me, he's one of our great engineers, and he's also handling all the sound tonight. And then one person I want to recognize, our super volunteer, Miguel Castro, who's outside probably checking people's names off at every event that we do. Miguel is here. He's also a significant other of Adrienne Zachary, but he really works hard. So could you please give him a big round of applause? I want to also recognize members of our community advisory board. If any of you are in the audience, I don't want to embarrass you, but could you please stand? Please give these folks a round of applause for all the work that they put in to help us do great work at the station. Our guest tonight is one of the hosts of Morning Edition, David Green. He does that along with Steve Inskeep and Renee Montaigne. I don't know if you really realize this, but Morning Edition is the most listened to news program in the country, which is pretty cool. I know many of you have never seen David, but I'm guessing that most of you have probably heard his voice, his very distinctive voice. David became familiar with NPR listeners as the White House correspondent. He covered the Bush administration. And to report on George W. Bush, his second term, David spent many an hour in the spacious booth in the basement of the West Wing, which was about the size of this space right here, very, very small. He also spent time trekking across five continents while he was reporting on President Bush, places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Mongolia, Rwanda, Uganda, and of course, the inimitable Crawford, Texas, where he spent time. David was an integral part of NPR's coverage of the historical 2008 election, covering Hillary Clinton's campaign from start to finish. And I don't know, maybe David will be back on the road again if Hillary decides to run in 2016. That campaign also was focusing on racial attitudes and how they were playing in voters' decisions back in 2008. The White House Correspondents Association took special note of David's report on a speech by then-candidate Barack Obama addressing the nation's racial divide, and Green was given the association's 2008 Miriam Smith Award for deadline coverage of the presidency. David is also, before joining NPR in 2005, David spent nearly 7 years as a newspaper reporter for the Baltimore Sun, where he covered the first term of the Bush administration. And I also think he probably had a cameo appearance in The Wire during that period, if you're familiar with that. Maybe I'm mistaken. Before graduating magna cum laude from Harvard in 1998 with a degree in government, Green worked as the senior editor on the Harvard Crimson. And in 2004, he was named co-volunteer of the year for Coaching for College, a Washington, D.C. program offering tutoring to inner city youth. David is a native of Pittsburgh. He loves the Pirates. He loves the Steelers. And just get him talking about sports, and you can talk to him for about 45 minutes. He'll do that alone. So would you please give a big Boise welcome for Mr. David Green.
Thank you, John. How is everybody? Thanks for coming tonight. This is a wonderful crowd. What a beautiful setting behind you. This is like a, we should take a group photograph. I am really, really happy to be here. John kept his promise. I can say he is a man who keeps his word. A colleague of mine and I were here about a year ago doing some political reporting, and I had such a fantastic time. And I asked John if I could come back sometime and not work and actually just spend an evening chatting with people. And he said, yes, we'll make it happen. And he made it happen. And here I am. Boise State Public Radio is such an important part of this community. And this community is lucky to have it. And Boise State Public Radio is lucky to have this community. And when a public radio community is truly special, it goes both ways. Like that. John, you have an incredible news staff. You have an incredible staff. You have an incredible organization. We know that in Washington, and I'm sure all of you are familiar with what they do and the work that they do, keeping you informed, enriched, entertained, connected. I mean, it's really the power of radio, the power of journalism, and the power of an organization that is truly part of the fabric of a community. And so it's just really an honor to be here. So let me just give them a hand, my hosts this evening. So I want to spend a little bit of time tonight talking about radio and then talking about Russia, because it has been an obsession of mine for the last few years. Part of the last few years were spent working on a book, which is now out, and if you'll indulge me a little bit, I would love to talk about it, because I think it says a lot about Russia today, and I learned a lot about the country working on it. It's obviously a country that's in the news and very important, and one that is very difficult to understand. And then I would be happy to take your questions and just hang out and chat, which will be a lot of fun. So I came into radio, as John mentioned, from being at a newspaper, the Baltimore Sun, and it was not the easiest transition from print to radio. I was very, very lucky to have an incredible mentor, my friend and colleague Don Gagne, who was covering the Bush White House by himself for the first 4 years. I'm not sure how he did that. And then there were two of us covering it. It was so much work. I told Don, I don't know how you did this by yourself. But Don is just a dear friend, a wonderful mentor. He taught me radio. But I ignored one of his first lessons, which I live to regret. Don and I shared this little booth in the basement of the West Wing. And Don said, you know, there's one trap that you can't fall into. You know, you have to close this door when you're recording something. But once you're done recording, open the door. Don't forget to open the door. I said, I got you, Don. Got it. So I was covering the White House by myself for the first day. And this was, you know, the beginning of my radio career. I was excited to get on, you know, one of the shows, All Things Considered, Morning Edition. And I'm sitting there in the White House just sort of, I had recorded a newscast spot and I was enjoying the moment, sort of sitting there thinking about, I'm really happy to be covering the White House for NPR. And the phone rang and I quickly picked it up and I said, you know, hi, it's David. And David, it's Ron. Ron's our senior Washington editor. I said, hey, Ron. He said, what's going on there? And I said, oh, I'm just covering the news for you here, covering the White House. And he said, oh, well, I'm watching CNN. The White House was just evacuated. And I said, yeah, right. Yeah, it was. Let me go kind of report on that. And so I opened the door, and it was really dark. This security lights were flashing, and there was a Secret Service agent there. And he was as surprised to see me as I was to see him. I said, what's up? He said, well, there's a plane in White House airspace, so we've evacuated the building. I was like, so I should leave now. And he said, well, it's probably to a point where it would be safer for you just to stay here in the bunker. I was like, I'll stay here with you. That's fine. That's good. So things cleared up pretty quickly. The plane left White House airspace. And about 2 days later, I got a phone call from a producer for Peter Sagal at Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which, as great as that show is, that's not the one you want to be on when you first started NPR as a news reporter. So they played Danger Zone by Kenny Loggins from Top Gun, And they said, what building in Washington was evacuated this week? And someone said the White House. And Peter said, yes, the White House, where everyone was taken out of the building except for NPR's David Green. David, you're on the line with us. What were you doing in that building? So that was my introduction to radio. So I have taken every piece of advice that Don Gagne has ever given me since that moment. And so I spent time covering the White House and then spent 3 years in Russia as NPR's Moscow correspondent, and now have come to Morning Edition. And it is really an honor to work for this program. I have two wonderful colleagues in Rene Montaigne and Stephen Skeep who could not have been more welcoming to me when I came on as the third host. But beyond them, this program is such a team effort. We have a staff that is working round the clock. I mean, if at any point you wake up at 1:30 in the morning, you know, to go to the bathroom or something, there is someone at Morning Edition in Washington working. And it's just a show. The show evolves over the course of those 24 hours with each people on each shift kind of shaping what the show will look like in the morning. It's just this wonderful process and an incredible team. And, you know, just to think of the people I have been able to interview and sit down with or speak to, it's truly humbling. And, you know, often I just ask myself why I deserve to be in this position. And I want to play you just a little bit of sound in a second to give you a window into my life. And I'll set this up a little bit. You're about to hear, I'll tell you, and then you can listen. Barry Manilow, Bette Midler, and TLC, the band, the music group. No, it's like Waterfall. Don't stop. Don't go chasing waterfalls. Okay. So let me just acknowledge, and this is a little embarrassing, I like karaoke. And one of my go-to songs is Mandy by Barry Manilow. And so a producer on the show had this wacky idea about how I should approach an interview with Barry Manilow. And I thought it was just the craziest idea in the world. But when you're in the moment and you see sort of an opportunity for your bucket list, an item on your bucket list, you can't really pass up that moment. So here are 2 minutes of my life in the studio at Morning Edition. Barry Manilow, you wouldn't fulfill my bucket list and sing a bar or two of Mandy with me, would you?
With you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, ready? Oh, Mandy, and you came and you gave without taking, but I sent you away. Oh, Mandy. Okay. Well, you're in tune.
You're very generous. Wow.
That was great.
Thanks. You were great too, Mr. Manilow.
Thank you. Call me Barry. And I need you today.
Bette Midler jokes about what the headline of her obituary might read. Perhaps, Diva Dies in Hot Dog Mishap, or simply, Bette Dead. So in 2014, what's the headline you would sort of joke about would be how you're going to be defined?
I think it would be, she planted a million trees in New York City.
This is a very different person compared to the Divine Miss M.
I know, it's so sad.
Were you tearing up jokingly, or was that
No, I tear up. I'm like, I cried. Traffic lights.
I apologize for thinking you were joking.
Oh, no.
What struck you there when I asked you about the Divine Miss M?
Let's move on from death, shall we? Let's talk about life.
Two that took some years off, but we're still together. We're always TLC.
Yep.
Chili T-Buzz, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate
it. First of all, I have to say I love your voice.
Yeah, you have a good voice.
Wow, that's going to be
sexy.
Big sexy. Big sexy.
I'm serious. I'm like, dang.
Thank you.
So your new name is Big Sexy.
Yes.
So welcome to my life. All joking aside, there is something about our air and our approach to people and journalism that can, I feel, bring out the humanity and the humanness in even people who are famous, who we all know. And that Bette Midler moment, you know, I was sitting there with her in our studios in New York, and it was as awkward as it sounded, because we were having this conversation about, you know, the divine Miss M and this, you know, sort of persona that she had created and many people knew her for. And, you know, I said, you know, that the planting trees in New York, that doesn't sound like the image that we think of you. And she literally started tearing up. And I started laughing, thinking that this was her being funny. And then I just stopped myself. And, you know, it revealed to me a real tension in her life that I had never really thought about. You know, she had some, you know, regrets about the image and the craziness. And she wants to be seen. She wants her legacy to be something that's a little more calm and perhaps more touching, not the crazy divine Miss M who we know. And so, you know, it's moments like that where I really appreciate, you know, that we spend time in our jobs being listeners and, you know, giving someone the space and the time and the safety and the respect, you know, to just sort of be themselves and tell their story, and that we're willing to let someone's story unfold before our eyes and with our ears trained on them. And I think that you can say that not just for people like Bette Midler and Barry Manilow and TLC, but it's the approach that, you know, that we take and that I take to journalism. And this goes back personally to my mother, who was an enormous inspiration in my life, both as a journalist and as a man. And she was this big personality on campus. She taught psychology at Franklin and Marshall College in Pennsylvania. And she was sort of known by everyone. She had these two English Springer Spaniels. She would walk them across campus. People would, you know, visit. And she just respected everyone. I mean, it didn't matter what job you were doing on campus, you know, how old you were, if you were student, faculty, staff, whatever. She just always wanted to be a listener. And, you know, she really drove home for me that everyone has a story to tell, and it's just a matter of listening and being respectful. And there was this incredibly powerful day and painful that, that, you know, has stuck with me forever and sort of is the backdrop to my journalism career. I was covering George W. Bush's trip to New Orleans, and this was in April of 2006. So we're talking about 7 or 8 months after Hurricane Katrina. And the president went to the home of a woman named Ethel Williams, who she was in her early 70s. Her home was completely ripped to shreds. She was in the Ninth Ward. And the president came and visited her and stood with her outside as, you know, we were all with our microphones and cameras. And they had this, you know, pleasant exchange where the president said he was going to rebuild Ethel's house. And Ethel said, you know, when you do, I'm going to cook you some gumbo and dirty rice. And, you know, we left that moment and went back to the airport in New Orleans and got on Air Force One. And I called my mother to check in with her. And she had just won this teaching award at Franklin and Marshall. Her students loved her. And we talked for a few minutes. I told her about Ethel. And then we took off, and I landed at Andrews Air Force Base and found out that my mother had suddenly died. And, you know, that was the most painful moment and day of my life, and it will remain so. But as I, you know, started to think about her life and her influence on me and her legacy, I somehow knew that I had to follow Ethel. Like, it was just too connected in this really strange way. And so I went back to visit Ethel several times. And, you know, over the months, her house was never rebuilt. The FEMA money, you know, didn't get there as quickly as it was supposed to. And she just never lost faith. And this was a woman who, if you, you know, were to rely on poll numbers and polling, you know, there's no possible way that she would support you know, a Republican George W. Bush. She lived in a heavily Democratic city. She's African American. You know, the pollsters would say that it would be very unlikely. But she felt that she had a friend in him. And that moment when he made that promise, you know, stuck with her. And I would sort of challenge her and say, Mrs. Williams, you know, politicians of either party, it's like, you know, how do you trust them? They tell you, you know, they tell you they're going to make you a promise and they're going to rebuild your house. Do you really believe that? Can you trust politicians? And she just, her faith was unending. And it was so inspiring. And her story and her belief in him, you know, some people who, you know, would respond to the pieces I was doing would say that she was naive. And I just, it would make me angry because there was just such a genuineness to her. She was such a tough, tough woman. And her story was so nuanced. And had I not been open to listening to her and what she believed in, I never would have gotten to the true Ethel Williams. So the sad ending to the story is that the money did finally come through for her house. But unfortunately, Ethel passed away before she was able to move into her new house. But Ethel and, you know, my mother's belief that everyone has a story to tell, and the story of Ethel to me, and just that her sort of belief and faith in politics and in the president and in friendship, there was something really, really touching and special about that that has really inspired me. And so that is the approach that I have always taken to journalism. You know, I want to be a listener, and as much as I possibly can, you know, just go where curiosity takes me and listen to people and their stories. And, you know, you can't always, you know, in the craziness of a show and live interviews, you know, it's not always, you know, I can't always feel like I'm acting on that at every moment, but, you know, I do it as much as possible. And after President Obama won election in 2008, you know, we were thinking, some of my editors and I, about, you know, how we can sort of capture a moment. This was a time in the country when the economy was in deep, deep trouble. You know, there had just been a historic election, and we decided that I would take a road trip. And so I set off for President Obama's first 100 days. I traveled all of I-75 from the UP of Michigan to Miami, and then went from New York to San Francisco. And I just listened. And, you know, we set up an email address for people to suggest where I would go next, and, you know, suggest stories that I should tell. And that was just a wonderful kind of journalism. You know, we can parachute into places and think that we understand a place as best we can, but to be out there in a country on the road nonstop was just a powerful way to understand this country at a certain moment. And so that brings us to Russia. So I spent 3 years in Russia, and it is a confounding, confusing country that people have been trying to make sense of for generations. And I spent 3 years there and can still not make sense of the place. I don't know if anyone can. But my editor and I decided that at the end of 2011, as I was wrapping up my time in Moscow and ready to come back to Washington to take the job at Morning Edition, we thought, wouldn't it be cool to jump on the Trans-Siberian Railroad and take the trip across the entire country, the largest country on Earth, and see what we could learn. And it was a fascinating time in the country, because 2011, there were protests that many of you might remember in Moscow, large anti-government protests. And I have to tell you, to protest in Russia is an act of courage. This is a place where the president of the country, Vladimir Putin, has said, if you are on the streets protesting without a permit, you should be clubbed in the head. So the fact that thousands of people were out there protesting was a big deal. But at the same time, as I traveled across the country and made my way into far-flung communities, you know, I was just getting the sense that this was not Russia's Arab Spring, as a lot of the reporting by Western news organizations was suggesting. The story just seemed much more complicated. This was not a protest movement that was catching fire, you know, that a spark had been lit, and this was a country that was ready for revolution. And you know, I learned so much from that trip. We aired a series of pieces on Morning Edition. I came back and started the job at Morning Edition, and I got a call out of the blue from a book agent named Howard, who's now a dear friend of mine, but I'm very mad at him. So Howard said, I think you should do a book about this Trans-Siberian trip. And I said, Howard, I just got back from being in Russia for 3 years. My wife and I are really happy to not be really cold anymore. She's Sicilian Lebanese. She has warm blood. She really didn't like Russia that much. For me to say, hey, honey, I'm going to go back to Russia for, you know, a month and a half for a book. I don't know if that's going to go over that well. And he said, well, just write me like an anecdote from the trip. I was like, okay. So I wrote him, you know, like a half a page. And he said, oh, this is good. This is good. Write me like 10 pages. And I said, Howard, do you think I'm stupid? Like, I know what's going on here. You're manipulating me. He was like, no. Just write some stuff. You know, I'm really enjoying this. And I was a willing victim of his manipulation. And he got me to finish a book proposal, which part of which was that I would go back and take this trip again. So I went back in 2013 and jumped on the train and spent 5 weeks crossing Russia a second time. And this time, my colleague, Sergei, who is the NPR producer in Moscow, we decided that we would do things a little differently on this trip. The first trip, we had gone some second class, some first class, which means you get an actual enclosed cabin. Sergei and I thought it would be really wise if we, you know, traveled with real Russians and went third class, which is basically an open dormitory room. And it is crazy. There is a lot of life on a Russian train. Amtrak is now really boring. I mean, you are on this train with, I mean, if I can explain it, it's in this sort of space here, there would be 6 bunks. There'd be an aisle, then there'd be 4 beds here, kind of one on top of one another, and then 2 over here, and then a whole next 6. So if you think about traveling, you know, just hours and hours and hours, I mean, every smell, every sound, everything anyone is doing, you're just all together in life. I sort of describe the snoring as orchestral. You know, it would normally start as you were going to bed. There'd be, you know, one person, then another would sort of chime in, then it would all come together with different cadence and different rhythms, and it was just great. It was like an orchestra playing. My wife, who came on the first trip, my wife is Rose. She had just started a business in Washington, so she could not come for the entire second trip, but she decided that she would spend a week. And so she arrived, and I had forgotten to tell her about this whole third class decision that Sergei and I had made. So we're walking on the train platform in Novosibirsk past all the first and second class cars, and Rose is sort of looking curiously at me and saying, is there another car towards the back of the train that is, you know, where room is going to be? I was like, oh, honey. So I explained to her, and I said, you know, we're in third class, but I said, it's not what you think. It's been sort of a wonderfully non-threatening environment. It's been families. It's been people of all ages, you know, just chatting and eating food. It's been absolutely lovely. And so we get on this particular train that night, and it is an entire train car full of young 20-something men who were on the route from Central Asia coming up and looking for work in Russia. So they were boisterous, they were rambunctious, and I don't think they had seen a female in days. So Rose got on the train, and they began catcalling her and cooing at her, and I thought this was the end of my marriage. So Rose immediately took out her iPhone, and she started recording a video, and she said, "Dear future children, the fact that you're alive means that I did not kill your father on this night, but I wanted to just capture the moment because this is what he subjected me to at 11:30 p.m. in Novosibirsk, Russia." And she started panning the camera. And so we have this video forever, which she promises never to let me forget. But on a much more serious note, I want to just introduce you to a couple of the people I met on this train trip, because, you know, I learned a lot from them, and I still don't pretend to understand Russia. You know, I worked on this book and met people along the way, not pretending like, you know, meeting 100 people was going to give me some definitive idea of where this country is going. But every single person and story sort of, you know, just anecdotally just helped me understand this country just a little tiny bit more. So the first people I want to introduce you to are near the city of Yaroslavl. And I don't know if anyone loves hockey, if that the name of that city rings a bell, but in 2011, the Yaroslavl Lokomotiv, which is the professional hockey team in Yaroslavl, Lokomotiv means locomotive, and they were sponsored and supported by the train industry in Russia. They were preparing to take a flight to their first game of the season on the road, and the plane crashed shortly after takeoff and killed the entire team. And this is, I mean, hockey teams in Russia are, I mean, you know, as John mentioned, I'm a Steelers Penguins fan. I mean, it's hockey is an obsession. Professional sports teams are part of, you know, communities. People, you know, live with their successes and failures. And that was the case in Yaroslavl. The city was absolutely devastated. And so Sergei and I went to a hockey game, and before every game they would play, you know, sort of somber music remembering the fallen players. And then we went to meet a couple, Sergei and Lubov, who were the parents of Nikita, who was one of the young players who was killed on the team. And, you know, I wanted to learn about their experience going through tragedy and to talk to them a little bit about their country. And so I just want to read you a little bit of the conversation that I had. So I'm sitting there in this living room, and there was Lubov showed us the room that has basically become a museum to remember her son. There was a photo of him, and I mean, he looked like he could have been 15. I mean, it was just devastating. And she had his two hockey gloves sort of attached to the photo as if they were his hands coming out. And so this is just a bit that I wrote about her. What strikes Lubov most is the uncanny attitude of public officials and other people in power when tragedy strikes. When it comes to ordinary people, we felt support from everywhere, the entire community. We felt everyone was with us and shared this with us. But as for the other category, the government, team management, the attitude from their side to those who suffered is a situation impossible to find in any other country. No one from the team ever called us to ask how we were doing. I wonder if some part of that is a sense that tragedy is just part of life, a way to make people stronger. And Lubov nods. There is this belief in our country, she said, that tragedy is a test for people who are supposed to be strong. And Sergei and I are strong. That's why we will get through this. I still have both my parents alive. Sergei has his parents. Nikita loved his grandparents very much. So we can't be weak. We have our old people to take care of. They need our support. We've always needed revolutions and wars, Nikita's dad says, because after each of those tragedies, we rise and are reborn again. But why do people in Russia believe that, I ask. Lubov thinks for a moment. We probably don't know how to live any other way. And so this was such a reminder to me of history as a backdrop in this country. You know, there are other countries, including this one, that, you know, have suffered through incredibly hard times. There are many of us have gone through very hard times. And I'm not suggesting that Russia is, you know, alone or unique in some way, but there is something in the Russian soul that Lubov and Sergei were speaking to. And the other lesson that I learned from this visit came with flowers. So when Sergei and I were going to see this couple, I said to Sergei, we should bring some flowers to them. We were visiting their apartment. And we stopped at a flower shop outside on the street. And I said to Sergei, I said, you know, should we get, you know, half dozen roses, a dozen roses? And Sergei said, David, stop. you know, you have to think seriously about this, because an even number of roses in Russia is either bad luck or it is for people who are in mourning. And I said, well, thank you for telling me that over the past 6 months when I've been giving roses to my wife in even numbers in Russia. But so Sergei and I thought about this. He had lost his mother. I had lost my mother. We both, you know, knew that when you lose someone close to you, you never really recover. It's always still with you. But at the same time, each individual, you know, has to go through a thought process as to when they want to at least try and move on. You know, when does it go from mourning to a celebration of life? And this is a very personal decision that everyone has to make. And so Sergei and I thought for a while, and we decided that we would bring Lubov five roses, hoping that she was sort of past at least some of the pain of losing her son. And when we gave the roses to Lubov, she gave me this, you know, sort of nodding approval, which made me happy as thinking that I'd made the right decision. So fast forward to the end of this day, and there was one more stop that I wanted to make before getting back on the train. And it was a memorial to a gulag that used to be located right outside the city of Rybinsk, which was near Yaroslavl, where Nikita's parents live. So I'll just read you a bit here. Sergei and I waved down a taxi. Our driver, a young guy in a black leather jacket, has never heard of this place. Gulag, Sergei keeps saying. My colleague finally makes a phone call to a local museum, hands the phone to our driver to hear the directions, and we're on our way. The driver's blasting techno music with English lyrics that in no way align with my mood. Neither Sergei nor I are speaking. I'm in the back seat watching Rybinsk pass by. There's the jet engine factory where Nikita's dad works, a sprawling, dirty complex that probably hasn't changed much since Soviet times. We continue through the center of town, past a snow statue of Russia's Santa Claus. Weeks after Orthodox Christmas, it's probably time for Santa to be relieved of his duties. The red paint from his hat is bleeding into the muddy snow, but no one has taken him down yet. And just outside town, we pull over, and our driver points across a field to what appears to be nothing more than a clump of snow. Sergei and I tromp 50 yards, and as we approach, we see the mound of snow is actually covering a rock. There's a plaque on the front of the rock that Sergei translates for me. This is the beginning of remembering victims of the Volga camps. It says beginning, Sergei points out, and I can see his breath in the frigid cold. Because, David, we could not talk about this for many, many years. We could not see monuments like this. We could not see anything. In other words, in this country, some tragedies happened long ago, but there is a reality that outsiders might struggle to understand. Since public displays of emotion were frowned upon for years, many Russians are just now coming to terms with their history and the pain. They're only now beginning to mourn what was lost. In the snow beside the rock, just below and to the left of the plaque, there's a bunch of flowers. They're red roses, fresh ones, as if put here within the past day or so. And I can't help but count the number, 6. And those 6 flowers have stayed with me, the image, since I was there in that moment. Because that said to me that someone in this city had come to mourn the loss of victims of the gulags, and after decades believed that mourning was still happening. And that was a moment that again, you know, was one more tiny step towards understanding, trying to understand this country. And so I want to tell you about one other stop. And it's a few hours, probably like 30 hours, east of Yaroslavl. It's in the village of Sagra, which is in the Ural Mountains. And in this village, they had something sort of akin to a showdown at the OK Corral. It's a tiny village, you know, sort of a smattering of homes, all just buried in snow. You know, there are animals sort of wandering about. The train would go by, flying by sometimes, just the train whistle going. There was one store in town, and basically they sold produce and every kind of cheap vodka you could imagine. And I went here because of this incident a year before my first visit. I stopped here on both times in the train because I was so fascinated by it. There was a gang that was infiltrating this village, Sagra, and they were sort of increasingly making their presence known. No one knew if they were coming in to sort of get involved in the corrupt lumber industry or if they were trying to, you know, find a place to sort of hide and sell drugs. But they were seen in the town a lot more often. And there was one particular night when a neighbor was a few miles up the road and saw this gang coming in a big numbers. And so a few people in town called the police, and the police never showed up, which is common in Russia. And so residents of the town took pitchforks and rifles and basically defended themselves as this gang came in. One of the gang members was killed, and immediately the local prosecutor charged the town residents, the village residents, with hooliganism. Now, in Russia, there is this reality that when you are charged with something, you are pretty much convicted of that. There's the conviction rate for crimes when charged is, you know, in the upper 90%. It's crazy. And when a local prosecutor decides that this is the way it's going to be, that local prosecutor, he or she, is probably well connected to the powerful. The decision has been made. You know, the book is closed. But several people decided that they were not going to let that happen. They wanted there to be, they wanted the truth to come out about what people in town were doing, and they wanted a fair trial. And so Andrei Gorodilov, who is exactly my age, late 30s, his father was one of the people who was charged with hooliganism. Andrei has a master's degree in economics. He's a business owner. His wife was interested in opening a business. Andrei and I really hit it off. I felt this deep connection with him, thinking that we sort of had the same worldview. He traveled a lot around the world for his business. And so Andrei and this lawyer decided to fight back. They got the truth out. And they did something incredibly rare in Russia. They won their battle against the local authorities. The charges of hooliganism were dropped. Andrei's father was safe from these charges. So were the other people in town. And Andrei told me that publicity was his protection. And so when I went back to visit Andrei on the second train trip, I really wanted to talk to him about that. Because it struck me that this was a moment. This was a moment when democracy seemed to be at work. And democracy was being taught somehow. And so I sat down with Andrei. There was vodka, although he doesn't drink, but I made sure to play my role. I was drinking with his father. We were in this neighbor's house just chatting. In this case, publicity was our protection. Okay, Andrei, publicity is your protection, a belief that the truth can expose a corrupt power. Aren't those democratic values? Yes, Andrei said, and we have to protect them. When I studied at university, I was taught that the police, the authorities, should fulfill their duties for the state. Their only motivation should be, what can I do for the people? But the state machine that we have works in favor of itself. I remember the lectures. They're supposed to work for the people. Okay, so a government for the people, I say. Andrei cuts me off. He senses where I'm going. But our Russian mentality has to be protected too. Russian mentality? You can't impose an ideology on a country. Other people often talk about Russians as lazy alcoholics. I'm not lazy, and I don't drink, and I don't smoke. This accusation of laziness has him animated. In Soviet times, the flight of stairs was cut off for a Russian person. He can't move up. If and when this formula changes, then everything will work, and we'll feel those values. We're on to a second plate of meat and pickles now, refreshed from the fridge. So, Andrei, what now? Are Russians just waiting? This will all develop gradually. But no, we can't just sit and wait. Well, you told me last time I was here that the answer is not a bloody revolution, I say. Right, he says. That would be death to our country. But the answer is also not to sit and wait, I say. Civil society, he says, needs to be developed. We all have to take our own small steps. Truth be told, that comes directly from the message playbook of Vladimir Putin and his cronies. They often say that Russia's citizenry is not yet developed enough to have true democracy. Did the experience here give you personally more faith in these values we're talking about, I ask? Andrei pauses. When all this happened, I made a lot of friends, and in our life, the most important value is the human resource. So I was perplexed by Andre, thinking that this was going to be some democratic lesson that had been taught. And I left with two thoughts. One was that he used two words, small steps, which I think were really important, because once I stopped looking for huge, massive protests on the streets of Russia, I started looking for smaller battles that were being waged that would sort of begin to infuse some of the values that we hold dear, you know, in a country and a people that's not used to them. And if there's small steps and small battles, this was one of those small battles. So I wanted to stop myself from kind of dismissing what Andre had said as if like, oh, you know, why didn't you learn the lesson here? These were democratic values. But the larger point that I took from Andre was that, you know, who am I to impose my Western assumptions and ideology on him? You know, it was fine for me to ask these questions, but, you know, we have different histories and different backgrounds. You know, one of the conversations that Andre and I had was about Libya. And he said, Libyans are going to be far worse off without Muammar Gaddafi. And my first reaction to that was, my God, what are you talking about? I mean, he's a brutal, terrible dictator who, you know, the West decided they should overthrow. You look at Libya today and the chaos that is there. And, you know, do I agree with Andre? I'm not going to say that. But does Andre at least have a valid point in thinking about that? You know, it certainly caused me to question a lot of things. And so as we think about Russia and, you know, the larger questions of Vladimir Putin and politics, and, you know, there's no doubt that Vladimir Putin runs a propaganda machine that is just ridiculous in its effectiveness. There's no doubt that he manipulates the political environment to make sure there is scant opposition. But if we want to pass judgment about Vladimir Putin and sort of authoritarian style, you know, I think we need to be very careful by then drawing conclusions about the Russian people, because they have their own history, they have their own culture. This is an incredibly smart, wonderful society full of amazing individuals and people with a deep, deep, rich cultural heritage, and they are finding their way right now. And they play a role in their future. And even when you live with an authoritarian leader who seems to run the show, you know, we can't forget that there are people who play a role and have a right to determine their future. And, you know, I think about what we're seeing in Ukraine today. I think about what we've seen in Russia. You know, I think back to the assumptions I made at the end of the Soviet Union, that a country like Russia would be on this inevitable path to Western-style democracy, and it would just be a matter of time, a short period of time, and Russia would be like the United States. And I look back and I feel like I was so wrong to make those assumptions. The world is so much more complicated. And it's not like there's a multiple choice offered to the Russian people. So you decide now what you want for the next 100 years in your country. Would you like a brutal authoritarian leader, or would you like a wonderful democracy with democratic values and freedom of the press? Like, you choose now. It's about what people are feeling in their lives as they think about their future at a moment. You know, during the Yeltsin years, you know, I think you could argue that democracy had a moment of opportunity in Russia, and many Russians felt failed by it. So it's not that this is a country full of people who don't know what democracy is and don't know what the benefits are. It's a much more complicated and nuanced story, and I think that it's important to remember that. So I'm going to read one more thing from this book and then stop, because I want to end on a slightly happier note. You know, when you report in Russia, if you're a journalist and you are Russian, it is one of the most dangerous places on the planet. And Western journalists would talk about this all the time, that the courage shown by Russian journalists who do their work every day in getting out the truth is absolutely incredible. Journalists have been murdered. I was there when a business reporter named Oleg Kashin, who worked for a very respected business newspaper, was beaten outside his home and they cut off several of his fingers, which, if you think about it, this is a man who whose livelihood and career depended on being able to type on a computer, so you can understand what message whoever did this was trying to send. For Western journalists, knock on wood, you know, we are not threatened. And that is one thing that during later Soviet times and during, you know, the years since, Western journalists have been able to operate fairly freely. But we do get little messages from the government that make you sort of live in a semi-paranoid state. I think the apartment that my wife and I lived in was totally bugged. We had like 9 smoke detectors. There was one day when I was studying my Russian language and I had my briefcase. This was when I first got to Russia. I was sitting in a cafe and my briefcase disappeared. And I, you know, was going to call the police, and Sergei and Boris is NPR's office manager, said, "Don't call the police. It'll just be worse if you involve the police." I'm like, "Oh, that's great to live in a place where that's the case." So the next day I got a phone call, and my wife picked up the phone. It was a woman who said in broken English, "My father found your bag and he wants to give it back." And I was elated. So we agreed to meet him at the puppet theater across the street from our apartment building. I brought chocolates, I brought flowers, thinking this guy was really nice to give me my bag back. And I asked him where he found the bag, and he said, "On the street somewhere." So I got back, and everything electronic had been taken from the bag. I got back to the office, and Sergei and Boris were sort of laughing. I said, "What are you guys laughing at? I got my bag back." They were like, "Well, who do you think took your bag?" I said, "I don't know. The guy found it on the street." They're like, "Well, did you have a business card in there or like a phone number or something?" I was like, "No." "Well, how do you think they found you and called you?" I was like, "Oh." So you can get paranoid. And that leads me to the final thing I want to read to you. This was a crazy night in the village of Uva, which is in the middle of Russia. We had gone there because a singing group of babushkas were vacationing, taking holiday in this small village, and I wanted to find them and interview them for the book. But the night before, Sergei and I were looking for a hotel. So being followed by people can get into your head and make you paranoid. Sergei and I find a hotel a short walk from the sanatory, which is where the health facility where the babushkas were staying. And we check in. The place is small, wooden, drab, with just 6 small rooms. Seems entirely empty, but as we walk across the creaky wooden floors and back toward our rooms, a man walks out of another room and immediately introduces himself. "My name's Vasily," he says in broken English. I extend a hand to shake. "Ochen priyatno, minya zovut David. Nice to meet you. My name's David." We carry on a simple conversation in a mix of basic Russian and English. Vasily learns that I'm a journalist from America working on a book. I learn that Vasily is a doctor on business in Uva. Vasily says we are the only people staying at the hotel. "Banya," he suddenly says, motioning outside. There's evidently a banya, a traditional Russian bathhouse attached to the hotel, and Vasily is proposing that we join him there. "Tonight," he says. I give a nod that I hope agrees to nothing more than maybe. Here's a moment when I want to believe this is Russia giveth, but I fear it is taketh, and I am caught in between. Vasily seems as unthreatening as you can imagine, a short, unassuming, friendly guy in his 50s with thinning hair and a bushy little mustache. He probably just wants a few friends to drink and steam the night away with. Then again, isn't it odd that he is the only other person staying in this hotel? Isn't it odd that he happened to be coming out of his room just as we checked in? Could he actually be working for the FSB, which is the modern-day KGB? I wrestle with whether I should let my paranoia and suspicion stand in the way of meeting a fellow traveler. I want to go to the banya, but I feel like precautions are in order. Maybe it's going overboard, but I decide we should be on guard, especially so if there's food or drink presented by Vasily. I prefer that Sergei and I never both consume the same item in case he has laced it with poison and intends to rob us. The banya is a truly Russian experience, and Vasily does it up. We meet him after dinner time in the small wooden building next to the hotel. He's brought beers, a bottle of vodka, glasses for both, pickles, and homemade horse sausage from his hometown a few hours away. All this is spread out over a wooden table. Vasily is banya ready in a green tank top and shorts. We've agreed that I'll partake of the bathing itself. Unlike most Russian men, Sergei isn't all that fond of the banya anyway, and he can stand guard over our things. Vasily tells me that he is, in fact, the chairman of his local banya society, so I am presumably in very good hands. He instructs me to remove my clothing, as much as I would like. Some men in Russia go full Monty. I typically hang on to the boxer shorts, and I am pretty happy when Vasily does the same. I've been to a banya half dozen times. I always feel cleansed and rejuvenated afterwards. Sergey, are you good? I say, looking at my colleague seated before a spread of horse meat and beer. Oh, I'm good, David. Enjoy. Vasily walks me through a thick wooden door into the next chamber where he tends to some mechanics. He opens the metal door to a compartment and ensures that a burning fire has a pile of stones good and hot. We then move to the third room of the wooden cabin, the bathhouse. There are wooden benches. I sit comfortably on one as Vasily opens another metal door and douses hot stones with water. There's a sizzling sound, and the heat in the bathhouse goes immediately from really hot to unbearable. I am sweating profusely. Arr! Vasily's making an animal sound, suggesting he's enjoying the heat. I would not call it enjoyable, but I do feel and appreciate the therapeutic nature of all this. I take a deep breath. The air is hot and clean as it runs into my lungs. David, he's trying to get my attention. This is not my first rodeo, and so I know what's about to happen. As per Russian tradition, Vasily has taken a birch branch out of a bucket where it was soaking, and he is motioning for me to lie down. I do, and he begins whacking me violently with the branch while making that animal noise. I really can appreciate most banya traditions, but the idea that violent contact with birch somehow adds to the experience seems like a stretch. After a few whacks, Vasily lies down and I return the favor. And after 10 minutes of this, we both return to the middle chamber where the next tradition awaits. There is a bucket of ice-cold water, and I dump it all over myself, screaming bloody murder, but knowing this is somehow making me a healthier and happier person, because why would generations of Russian men have done it otherwise? Vasily does his dunk. Both dripping wet and shivering, we return to Sergey and sit at the table. How was it? Great, Sergey. Thanks. You sure you don't want to turn? Yes. Sausage? Vasily's holding a chunk of horse meat in his right hand and a large sharp knife in the other. By this point, Sergey and I have concluded that Vasily seems genuinely harmless, though Sergey still decides not to drink the beer or vodka. I take one for the team there. Vasily and I are sharing a small bench in boxer shorts, our wet bodies all but touching. So you're a doctor, I ask, with Sergey generously translating. I'm a doctor of alternative medicine for animals. I'm here to treat cattle around Uva. They've been having infections in their hooves. He then cuts two hunks of horse sausage. We both chew them and wash them down with beer. I have a special honey that I invented that treats ailments. I'll give you some when we go back to the hotel. Vasily and I talk into the night about our jobs, our professions, our countries. You know, David, if you and I ran the two countries, there would have been no Cold War. We find this a whole lot funnier than Sergey does, perhaps helped by the beer and the vodka. Just another night in Russia. You can tell I love this country. I am excited to follow it as a journalist, as a writer. It is a special place with enormously warm people who have a very difficult road ahead in trying to figure out their future. You can also tell that I love radio. I love journalism. I love listening to people, which brings me to what I'm about to say. I would love to listen to you if you have any questions, and I'm ready to answer them. But I really appreciate you listening to me for this time, and thank you for having me here. Yes.
Two words I haven't heard you say this evening. Hillary Clinton. Can you comment on the 2008...
You want me to just say those two words, or... yeah, so I covered Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2008. Yeah.
Okay. I was going around with the microphone.
Oh, I should have waited for you. I've already messed this up. I'm sorry. Did everyone hear the question? I promise. I will wait for you next time. I owe you one. So let me take you to one moment in covering Hillary Clinton that I was talking to a few people before we got started, so apologies for repeating this. But this was after she lost in Iowa, after she won in New Hampshire, after all the stories about the famous tears, when a lot of people wrote about whether that was a moment when she had shown, you know, a vulnerability that she hadn't shown in the past, and whether that was a factor or was not a factor in her winning the New Hampshire primary. So fast forward to around Super Tuesday. It was Super Bowl Sunday, and the New York Giants were playing the New England Patriots. And we had this crazy day of campaigning. We were in something like 7 states, and we were finishing in St. Paul, Minnesota. And we were going to do the last stop of the day at a sports bar so she could be photographed watching the Super Bowl and shaking the hands of people who were watching the game. And she was a New York senator, so she had to, you know, show that she was paying attention to the Giants. So I had been asking for an interview for weeks. And finally, her staff came to me and said, we're going to do the interview with you at, you know, around 10:30 p.m. in the office of the bar manager in the back. I was like, I mean, okay. I mean, that doesn't exactly sound ideal after a long day of campaigning and while the Super Bowl is on. But, you know, you get an interview accepted and you take it. So she came back to this bar office and we spoke for about 15 minutes. And one of the things she said was that when you are running for president as a woman, it is extra work that you have to do to establish credibility. She had to first get Americans to accept the idea of a woman as president and then make the case that she was the right candidate. And this, I think, spoke to what we would often see, the different Hillarys in Iowa, in New Hampshire. You know, I think she felt like she had to put, you know, a tough outside out there for people as part of the effort that she was talking to me about that night. So I turned off my microphone and she kind of let out this sigh and she said, so I'm a little, I'm not going to go back out there quite yet. I might just stay back here and watch the Super Bowl. Do you want to watch with me? I was like, Hillary Clinton asking me if I want to watch the Super Bowl with her. I could, yeah, I got nothing else to do. Sure. Yep. Yeah. Can watch the Super Bowl. So we watched for a few minutes and just chatted. And all I'll say is that it was, you know, it was a different Hillary Clinton. And I remember wondering, you know, that night, you know, what would voters think if they saw the Hillary I was seeing in those moments after the microphone was off? And I don't know the answer to that question. You know, but that has stuck with me since then. I wonder if there, you know, if she was exhausted after a day of going to 7 states like I was. I was sure as heck exhausted. And I don't know how she wasn't exhausted. The entire press corps was exhausted. Her entire campaign staff was exhausted. Like, we were dead tired and ready to go to bed. And, you know, if she showed more vulnerability, if she showed fatigue that night, something, I just don't know. And, you know, especially not being a woman, I can't put myself in the shoes of a woman who is trying to travel the road that she was traveling. But, you know, the Hillary Clinton I saw in those moments after the microphone was off, I just was left wondering, you know, what would voters think then? And if she does indeed run, and if we see her run now, what will voters think, you know, in the next 12 months or so, if they see that side of her? And it's, you know, I can't answer that question, but all of you might be able to. Yes.
I really enjoyed the 2011 train ride. On Fridays, they would play your recap for your experiences. And wonder, Diane Rehm's show periodically does stream. Do you think that might be something that Morning Edition, or you're, because I know Steve, he's gone down to Mexico, because you would post pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed seeing after your story to go to the website and look at the pictures of the people that you were sharing the stories with. And then the last question is, do you think you'll get on Jon Stewart and do your book before he retires?
Let me answer your second question first. I don't know, but my father is such a Jon Stewart fan, he will not stop bothering me. And I mean, I don't think it's going to happen. I did the book tour and it's kind of over, but I want to keep the faith so my father will keep speaking to me. I mean, he's such a fan that he just keeps asking me over and over again. Jon Stewart, actually, there's a there's a John Stewart moment in my book, and it's worth, if you're into the craziness of Russia, pulling it up on YouTube. It's amazing. It was after, so I met a young man, his name's Ivan, and really powerful person in the book, his story. I met him because I was looking for remnants of the meteorite that fell over Chelyabinsk in Russia. And, you know, I'm kind of a Star Wars nut. The idea that you could touch an intergalactic souvenir is pretty cool. So John Stewart described the reaction of Russian drivers because a lot of Russian drivers have these dashboard cameras, and it's because they don't trust the police, which is a theme in Russia. And so they want to be able to show exactly what happened if they get in an accident. And so a lot of the meteorite was caught on these dashboard cameras, and John Stewart has this amazing segment where he just shows the reaction of these drivers. And it's like, oh. It's like a meteorite is about to hit your city. And then he shows some of the crazy footage from these dashboard cameras that people have picked up. And honestly, you begin to realize why a meteorite is just not that big a deal. I mean, there are military vehicles flying off the side of the road. There are, you know, trucks dumping cattle all over the road. There are people who will get into a fight with crowbars right in front of the car. I mean, it's just crazy. Your other question was, would we stream the... Oh, like the full interview. You know, we've done that sometimes where, you know, we'll have a 7 or 8 minute segment and then we'll post, you know, the full interview that we did with someone. I don't know. I think our digital team often thinks about that, and I know they're picky about what they don't want to constantly put large chunks of audio up because they don't want to inundate people. But you know, we've done it before. We've put full interviews up, and I will take that suggestion back to Washington with me.
So David, you said you're in your 30s, you've traveled the world, famous politicians, famous people. Two questions to this. One is, what gets you up every morning to move forward personally? And then all you've done at this age, what are some of your aspirations for the future that you dream about and think that I want to do that?
Good questions. The 2 hour show every morning gets me up. I'm saying that seriously. It is guiding, you know, listeners like yourself through kind of the day's news and capturing this day as best we can. And, you know, I feel really honored and energized by being able to do that. You know, when I sit there in that studio every morning, you know, it can be, you know, if Steve's there, the two of us are kind of together and it's nice. But if it's me and Renee, it's like, you know, she's in LA and, you know, studio can be really lonely. I'll often imagine, you know, and I'll pick different parts of the country and different circumstances. I'll imagine, you know, a family waking up and having breakfast and having the radio on. You know, I'll imagine someone in their car commuting, stuck in traffic on, you know, a beltway in a city somewhere. I'll imagine someone driving through the mountains listening, you know, someone running, you know, because I want to have that connection. And, you know, I really imagine myself as sitting there with you and asking the questions that you might ask, being curious together. And, you know, that really excites me. And it's an honor to do that. And I think that gets me up in the morning. I don't know. I loved covering the White House. I feel, you know, one of the lucky few who had, you know, an office in the West Wing and got to, you know, follow the president almost every day. You know, living in Russia and, you know, being a foreign correspondent for NPR, especially in this day and age, when so many news organizations are shutting down foreign bureaus, you know, that the role that we play is becoming even more important to make sure that people stay connected to the world. And I love my job right now. If I could have this job with slightly better hours. No, but I really, you know, I'm really inspired right now. And I think I would love to find, you know, Russia is my current obsession. You know, I would love to find another place, country, culture to dig into next, and not knowing what it is yet is kind of exciting. But I feel really lucky. Yes.
First, thank you very much for coming tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to let you know that I listen to you and your colleagues on my way into Boise State almost every morning, and I have told my students in my politics and government classes that you are one of the major sources of really good news.
Thank
you. Second thing is this. When you talk with Wade Goodman, Goodwin the next time, ask him what kind of weather he had when he came out in November. It was the worst night of the whole winter.
Yeah, I heard about that. And you know, ask him where he lives, though.
Yeah.
He lives in Texas. I lived 3 years in Russia. So I deserve this.
And third, I really want to compliment you in the interview that you had with Slava Fetisov. We heard that just recently. And he was the hockey hero who was called back to become what the minister of one of the youth programs.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about being perplexed. It sounded like you were perplexed when you were ending that interview and you were asking him about the Ukraine and Russia's involvement in Ukraine. Were you surprised with his answers that he gave to you?
So let me just, for people who didn't hear this, this was Slava Fetisov was one of, if not the greatest hockey players in the Soviet Union. He was a defenseman. He was part of the Soviet Red Army team that, you know, basically ruled the world until they lost to the Americans in Lake Placid, which I brought up to him, and in a very non-gloating kind of way. It's kind of like, you know, let me just get this out of the way first. You know, that was pretty bad, wasn't it? But he's an amazing story. He was offered to defect to play for the New Jersey Devils and decided not to because he cared so much about his country. Then the Soviet government said, okay, you can go play in the United States, but you will only get $1,000 and you will have to give the rest of your contract money to the Soviet government. And he wouldn't do it under those terms because he didn't think it was fair. And he was beaten at one point on the streets of Kiev by the authorities. And finally, he walked out on the Soviet defense minister and basically said, I'm leaving the army, because when you played Russian hockey, you were officially in the military. Eventually made his way to the United States, won 2 Stanley Cups with the Detroit Red Wings. And then Vladimir Putin, as you mentioned, offered him the job of Minister of Sports to come back to Russia. And given all of that, you know, he has a very, how can I put it? He seems to get his country, its strengths and its weaknesses. So I went into asking him about Ukraine, not knowing what was going to happen. And I wanted to both, you know, listen and not argue with him, but also ask him tough questions. And so, you know, he said that Vladimir Putin is committed to peace. And I said, you know, a lot of people in the West don't believe that when they see what's happening in Ukraine. And he said, Ukraine is a very local matter, you know, because it's a lot of people who are, you know, it's Russian speakers in Ukraine who are fighting for their rights. And I said, well, a lot of people in the United States and a lot of experts, you know, see evidence that Russia is very involved. And he said, Russia's not involved there, not involved there. And we finished by him saying, you know, he believes that his country is committed to peace and it's better to leave the blood on the ice instead of anywhere else. And so I don't know. He's a smart guy. He knows the world. He's lived in both Russia and the United States. I'll say this. I believed, how can I put this articulately? I'm in the communications business. He believed what he said he believed. I don't think he was lying. Whether that means he had been sold on the propaganda, you know, or just bought into, you know, lies from the Kremlin, or, you know, whether it's much more complicated. You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I'm glad it's a voice we got on the air, because it, you know, hearing the Russian side of things in a respectful way from people who are willing to be thoughtful about it is pretty rare. And so I think we need to get as many voices like that on the air as we can. Yes, sir.
Besides NPR, world coverage is also significant with the BBC. I listen to both programs, especially yours every morning. But do you view BBC as competitors, or do you collaborate? Is there interface between specific stories that are erupting in any certain area? Because certainly they have coverage equal, at least, to NPR's reach around the world.
Do we compete in that we're both trying to, you know, tell stories around the world, and we're two news organizations with, you know, with that sort of reach. Sure. But in large part, it's a collaboration and I think a really deep mutual respect. And not just at NPR, but in the public radio community. I mean, you hear the BBC on, you know, many public radio stations because there's a feeling that, you know, that their values and their approach to journalism and covering the world is, you know, is true to our sensibilities. You know, I respect them, you know, a lot, and I think they respect us. And, you know, just to give you one example, our London bureau, Ari Shapiro, you know, that bureau is housed in the BBC. We have a producer who works for us in London, but that person, he or she, is borrowed from the BBC on a yearly basis. We get someone new. And so there's real deep collaboration there. And, you know, it's interesting. I think journalism can be, it can be cutthroat and competitive. And I look back to my newspaper days and, you know, I worked for the Baltimore Sun Carroll County Bureau. And I was covering the school system in Carroll County. Went to school board meetings, school board committee meetings, you know, all the time. And, you know, it's a small readership, but wow. I mean, if I got one thing wrong by that much, I heard about it. I mean, parents who are reading about schools and their kids, I mean, let me tell you, they will let you have it if you get something wrong. And our newsroom was basically on Main Street. And so anyone could just walk in and be like, so where's this guy, David Green? Oh, his desk is right over there. Oh, great. Hi. And so we competed against the Carroll County Times. And they had their own education reporter. And the fact that we were competing made us both better, made us both more driven, made us both more committed to spending the hours it took to get the story out. So competition is a good thing. That said, so is collaboration. And I, you know, think about moments of collaborating in my career at, you know, covering the White House. You know, there would be times when, you know, I would be interviewing someone and the person at a campaign event happened to be from Dallas, and my friend from the Dallas Morning News desperately needed a Texan in his story. So, you know, I would share, you know, the quotes from him, and you know, it's stuff like that. And, you know, especially covering in war zones. I mean, when I was in Libya, you know, there was a lot of working together. You know, we traveled around with a BBC crew because they had, you know, heavier security than we did. And so journalism is competitive. It can be collaborative. It's a long answer to your question. but I think the BBC and NPR, sensibilities, values, very similar, and I think deep, deep mutual respect. And so I don't fault you at all for listening to both. You should listen to both guilt-free and not worry about it.
Sorry, the question is, being a newspaper man, is journalism dying? And is the news dying?
Yeah, the short answer is journalism is not dying. I was at the Baltimore Sun and wanted to go abroad and had been offered the Jerusalem Bureau, the Baltimore Sun, by our foreign editor. And the next day, it was just a formality. The editor of our paper was supposed to call me and officially offer me the job. The Tribune Company, which is the large corporation who owns the Baltimore Sun, had gotten into a bit of an argument with the editor, And the way the story's been told to me is they were trying to get him to fire some newsroom staff. He refused to do it, and so they fired him. And this was, you know, just one more chapter in the economic squeeze that was affecting newspapers. And so that wasn't a good sign. And they took back the offers. They sort of thought about what they were going to do with their foreign bureaus and what the newspaper was going to look like with a new editor. And I sort of used that time to, you know, because I love that newspaper and learned journalism at that newspaper. It was an amazing place to be young. And they gave you the chance as a young person, you know, to learn the trade. And that was the first moment where I sort of doubted whether I wanted to be there anymore. And I started looking for jobs, and that's how I got to NPR. Within three or four years, the Baltimore Sun had shut down every single one of its foreign bureaus. And I got to a place where I was really, really pessimistic about the future of newspapers and sort of wondering where the heck journalism was going. I am now growing more optimistic, because when I look at newspapers like The Sun, they're physically, many are shells of their former selves. They don't have as many reporters. They don't have as much original stories from abroad. But there's an excitement that I think is building back again, that it's not just, you know, sound bites, which I think a lot of people were worried about a few years ago, that that's where journalism was headed. You know, I read a lot of things online now for the first time, really thoughtful commentaries and stories from abroad. There are new, you know, digital news organizations that are kind of popping up, that some of them, you know, don't do such a good job, but others really do. And I think it's a moment where journalism is trying to find itself again. There are a lot of things in journalism that bother me a lot. I think that there was a time when the anchor desk, and I include our anchor desk, you know, in that, you know, where that was such a sacred place, where someone sitting behind an anchor desk was unbiased, objective, fair, telling the truth. I mean, the days of Walter Cronkite, I mean, that was journalism at its best. I would like to think, you know, I truly believe that Steve and Renee and I, when we sit behind that anchor desk every morning, we are absolutely true to those standards and values from years past. But I don't think everyone is. And, you know, I think, you know, as you sort of make choices about cable news and what you're watching, you know, some of it's high quality and fact-based, but no longer can you turn on a television and look at someone sitting behind an anchor desk and have the same sort of assurance that you did 30, 40 years ago. And that's sort of sad. So journalism is evolving and changing. But, you know, a few years ago when I spoke to a college class and, you know, college students would say, should I go into journalism? I would kind of hem and haw, and I would say, I mean, I love it, but it's much harder to, you know, get through now because there are fewer jobs that, I just sort of blubbered on and didn't know what I was talking about and was clearly pessimistic, but trying to inspire. But now I'm really feeling like it's exciting times again. And, you know, I think there are new mediums, and there are places to sort of settle into jobs where you can, you know, still tell the truth and be objective and do what journalists should be doing. Yeah.
Quick question on how the inner workings of NPR and who ends up where, who does what. You ended up in, after covering the Bush White House, 3 years in Russia. Why you? Why then? Did Corey Flintoff win the lottery, or was he low man on the totem pole?
You think Moscow is low man on the totem pole? That's like the job everyone wants. It's with jumping to go to Russia. So when I was finishing at the White House, I knew I wanted to go abroad. It was a dream of mine. And I called our foreign editor, Lauren Jenkins, who is just an unbelievable journalist. And I said, I'd like to go abroad. And Lauren was sort of known for making people pay their dues. And he called me about a week later and he said, So how do you feel about Baghdad? And I was sort of like, well, if that's what I have to do to go abroad, you know, I can think about it. And so Lauren was from the tradition of working hard and playing hard as a journalist. And Lauren took me out to lunch, and over, you know, a few bottles of wine, basically convinced me that I was going to Baghdad. And, you know, he was telling these amazing stories that he was very famous for telling. He's a presence. He's a force. And he was inspiring and convinced me that this, you know, would be unbelievable and good for my career. And so I, you know, my wife and I talked a lot about it. You know, NPR was going to put me in an apartment in Beirut, and I would go 6 weeks into Baghdad and then have 2 weeks where I would come out. And, you know, my wife, Rose, would, you know, could live in Beirut, and she was, you know, excited about that. And then she and I were in an airport. We were coming back from Las Vegas, and I got an email that my former colleague, Ivan Watson, who's now at CNN, had an unbelievable close call in Baghdad. He was doing interviews inside a little shop, came outside, was getting ready to get in the NPR car, and an Iraqi police officer came running up the street screaming, "Don't get in the car, don't get in the car." They stepped back from the car, and an IED blew up the car. And so I showed Rose that email, and we both stood there at the airport and just started crying. And I realized that, you know, I wasn't ready to sign up for this. You know, some people are. And I cannot tell you. I mean, when you hear names like Kelly McEvers and Layla Fadel and Soraya Sarhadi Nelson and Deborah Amos, I mean, Lourdes Garcia Navarro, these are people who spent long amounts of time in incredibly dangerous places, and I tip my hat to them. I'm honored to be in a newsroom with them. I'm honored to work in an organization with them. It just wasn't for me. And it was one moment where I was so proud of where I worked because, you know, no one made me feel like a lesser journalist. You know, I had editors telling me, if you're not comfortable in Baghdad, we don't want you there. It's not good for you to be there. It's not good for us for you to be there. And, you know, you don't have to be a cowboy. You're no less a journalist, no less a person. I'm glad we figured this out now instead of in 3 months when you were in the bureau. So that's how I ended up in Russia. I said, okay, well, so if anything else comes up that's not Baghdad, let me know. And so Russia came up. And, you know, there's no perfect formula. You know, they interview people for that job who were Russia experts from newspapers who spoke the language. Would they have gone and told different stories and had a deeper understanding of the place and sort of the mechanics of the place and the history? You know, sure. Did I bring a fresh eye and a curiosity that someone who had been sort of enmeshed in the story for 2 decades? You know, probably. Or I'm just rationalizing. So there's no formula for it. I will say that NPR, one of the great things about being a foreign correspondent at NPR is you're based in a place, but you could end up anywhere. I mean, I was back in the United States on a leave, and I was talking to Lauren, the foreign editor, and he said, you know, the royal wedding is coming up. And I said, yeah, yeah. He was like, what do you think? I was like, Lauren, I don't even know who's getting married. I don't care. He was like, okay. I kid you not, a week later, I find out that I have been assigned to go join Phil Reeves in London and cover the royal wedding. I mean, it was like a cruel joke. And I loved it. I ended up loving it. So, it was effective in whatever he was trying to do. But, you know, I was based in Moscow, but ended up in Libya covering the Arab Spring. So, you know, we move people around a lot. And, you know, I think it's good to move into different jobs and, you know, use different muscles. And I've liked, you know, trying different things.